I'd like to tell you a story. It's not a very happy story, but then maybe you wouldn't expect one on a day like today. And it begins with a man by the name of Sir David Lionel Goldschmidt Stern Solomons. Now there's a name, Sir David Lionel Goldschmidt Stern Solomons. He was appointed honorary colonel of the Kent Fortress Royal Engineers, which was a part-time group of men on 6th of November 1908. And his son and heir, David Reginald Herman Solomons, served as captain. Sir David was a man ahead of his time. He owned the second ever motor car in England. He lectured on electricity, and the first ever meal cooked using electricity was in his home, Broomhill, which is now called David Solomon's House. It's about a mile away from where I grew up. I used to cycle by it every day to school, and Shirley and I have actually stayed in the house. It's a fascinating place. When the First World War broke out, they were mobilised. This part-time group became part of the war effort. On the 4th of August 1914, they were given the title 3rd Kent Battalion, and they went and did their training in awaiting the call to war. They were a group comprising pretty much local men from the area. By July 1915, they were at least 185 strong and received orders to sail to a place called Gallipoli, where the Allied forces were taking huge casualties. The company had a farewell dinner on the 11th of October 1915, and crowds cheered them as they set off to war, setting off in their trains to go to war. They boarded HMS Scotian, arriving in Malta 9 days later, and then they sailed to a place called Mudros, where they got into another ship, the HMS Hythe, to take them to Cape Helles at the southern end of the Cape of Gallipoli, where fighting was fierce between Turkish gun emplacements and Allied soldiers from France, Australia, and many other nations. The Hythe had been a cross-channel steamer, so it had no passenger accommodation, but they managed to arrange for a large canvas awning to be put up over the open deck to help to protect the soldiers from spray and the cold, wet weather. Officers, of course, were allowed into the engine room to keep warm. On the morning of the 28th of October 1915, five officers, including Captain David Solomons, together with 233 men, boarded the Hythe for a short 40-minute nighttime trip to Cape Helles. Because of guns firing from the shore, ships travelled that part of the area with no lights. And it's not hard to imagine a mixture of fear and uncertainty for those men in the darkness, maybe excitement even, that finally, after all the time of training and waiting back home, after so many days at sea, they would at last be able to fight for king and country. And so on the deck of that ship, friends, family members, neighbours, silently put on their kit and got ready to fight together. Then out of the darkness loomed another ship, bigger, sailing at speed, and though they tried to avoid each other, the Hythe was hit by the HMS Sarnia. The force was so great the Hythe stopped dead in the water and a mast broke, killing some of those on the deck. A hole was ripped in the side, and as the Hythe turned, water poured in. Some were able to get from the Hythe to the Sarnia, but most were not so fortunate. Many trapped below and many under the fallen awning. The Hythe sank in under 10 minutes. Others jumped into the cold waters, but with no life jackets, weighed down with their fighting kit, they had no chance. Captain Solomons gave his life jacket to a soldier before he himself drowned. A further 128 members of 3rd Company were lost, plus 15 other army personnel and 11 crew. It's not hard to imagine how the news of this affected the very tight-knit community in that part of Tunbridge Wells. One report says the postman delivering telegrams confirming that loved ones had been killed had so many in one road that he became overwhelmed and had to go back to the depot. One report says several pairs of brothers were lost, a father and son drowned together, some 99 children now have no father. That father and son was my great-grandfather, Simeon Till, and his son, my great-uncle Thomas. And one of those 99 children was my nan, Ethel, then aged 9. We'll come back to the story in a few minutes. I didn't know the story of HMS Hythe. Nobody ever talked about it in the family. Perhaps because my nan was so young, you know, it didn't get carried on. But I've seen one grainy picture of Simeon Till, and he and his son's names are on a war memorial that is outside of the parish church in the village where I grew up. My primary school is right next to the church, and I saw this stone monument every day. I played on it, I sat on it, because it had a bench and everything. They're also on the main Tunbridge Wells Memorial in the centre of town, and the number of times I caught a bus home from there, standing right next to it, and I did not know that the names of my great-granddad and my great-uncle were the names mentioned in there. They died in a tragic accident. They never got to fight, which seems, was that an even greater waste? I don't know. Especially as the powers that be in London were deciding to start pulling troops out of Gallipoli. Fred Mills was a survivor, and he witnessed what Captain Solomon did in handing over his life jacket. Fred wrote, "It is my opinion that if he had a thought of himself first, he would have been saved. And if I'm right, he died a hero's death, and we honour him." Gave up his life for one of his men. Since I found this out, I've found myself remembering Simeon and Thomas on this Remembrance Sunday, and those who died in what seemed to be such a sad and pointless circumstance. There's no glorious battle fought out here, though it took courage to be counted for the fight. There's no medals pinned on the chest of those grateful to have survived, just young lives lost and families devastated. I am proud of my family and of my other granddad who did survive fighting in France and lived out a good life. But war leaves its scars deep enough to last a lifetime, and they did for him. In his New Testament letter, James writes, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire, but you do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight." I mean, how many wars have been fought over what somebody else has and somebody else wants? Over boundaries, mineral wealth, past battles, ideologies, and so on. In the end, when God speaks and all that we know now is swept away for a new heaven and a new earth, boundaries won't matter, wealth won't count. And there's only one eternal truth that will last, that's Jesus, and on that day war will end. We get a powerful glimpse of it in Isaiah 2 with a prophecy that I think we would love to see fulfilled. This is what it says. "Many people will come and say, 'Let's go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths.' The Lord goes out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord." Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Wouldn't we love to see that? And in another Isaiah passage, which, like the carol we sang earlier on, takes us a few weeks ahead to Christmas, we see how and through whom peace will finally come. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from this time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." That's a guaranteed promise. Peace will come when Jesus comes. In the meantime, almost every nation trains for war. It seems to be what we do on this planet. And we remember the cost today. I found this in an online article about getting a different perspective on the world. There's this thing called the overview effect. It was a term that was coined in 1987 by Frank Wright in a book that he wrote. And he described the shift that astronauts experience when they see the Earth from space. It has an actual physical effect on them. As the borders and the divisions that separate nations become invisible, the article said, astronauts report feeling a deep emotional connection to the planet and a heightened awareness of its fragility and beauty. It changes their perspective because they see the bigger picture. Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield has spoken about the stunning beauty of Earth from space, emphasizing how it instilled in him a sense of responsibility to protect the planet. Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell described how looking at Earth made him feel a profound sense of responsibility towards humanity and the environment. Numerous astronauts use different words, but they describe the Earth as a tiny, fragile ball of life, suspended in a void of space, with its thin atmosphere appearing as a delicate shield. The vibrant blues of the ocean and the greens of the land stand out against the dark backdrop of space, creating a stunning visual experience that evokes feelings of awe and wonder. Viewing Earth from space profoundly impacted their perspective on life, unity, and environmental responsibility. The overview effect not only alters their understanding of the planet, but also inspires them to advocate for its protection and the well-being of its inhabitants. The overview effect. The further they physically got from what divides us, the closer they felt to what God has created. Which makes me wonder how God sees us. How does he look down at this terrible mess we make of his wonderful creation? I wasn't quite sure how to put this, but bear with me. It's perhaps one of the biggest sadnesses of war that it is too personal. We're too close to it. I know that sounds daft, but not just down to names on war memorials or countless rows of gravestones in France and Belgium and places like that, but that we do not get to see the bigger picture that the astronauts have seen. A world where borders cannot be seen, the value of things cannot be measured, where people are just people, each one precious, each one unique in history, not there to be wiped out. So in the meantime, we mourn those who gave their lives in war. And we find ways, don't we, to express our gratitude for that. Perhaps a little humbled, perhaps even embarrassed that it took so many to allow us to be free. What was billed as the war to end all wars has been followed by a century of war right across the planet. And to those who gave so much, maybe on a day like today, we have to say, sorry. The last line of Charles Wesley's great hopeful hymn, Love Divine, All Loves Excelling, looks forward to a day when we will cast our crowns before thee, lost in wonder, love and praise. Someone insightfully suggested that in the meantime, we are lost in blunder, mud and daze. I'm not suggesting that because the reality of sin is so strongly expressed in what divides us that we should have no part in peace, you know, that we just give up on it. That would be to ignore the call to be peacemakers. But we have to acknowledge that lasting peace, true peace, world-changing peace will come when Jesus comes. And he swipes away all that wounds and mars and scars what God has made. So maybe not just on a Remembrance Sunday, but every day when we look at the world and we try to work out how to pray for it, perhaps we need to echo the words from the very end of the Bible, Come, Lord Jesus. Let's pray.